G'day, it's Phil Edwards, Vision CEO here, with a quick invitation to become part of this amazing beacon of hope called Vision. Together we can put our love into action to help people of all kinds build or rebuild their lives on the truth of God. Please consider the part you can play during our upcoming Visionathon appeal, remembering that it's your support that makes Vision possible, including this podcast.
Life, culture, and current events from a biblical perspective. 2020 on Vision.
A conversation today about criminal justice and especially approaches to youth crime. We'll be talking about the extent that jailing may be failing young Australians. You might be wondering if Christians should be interested in issues around criminal justice. Well, a less talked about fact of our Australian history is the motivation for the inclusion of a Christian chaplain on the First Fleet. He would accompany convicts, and there was a view in that motivation to implementing penal reform in the new colony. So the first Christian chaplain was Richard Johnson. He was in charge of devising processes of law and order. So where are things at today in our communities? Well, our special guest today says there are significant shortfalls in criminal justice in Australia. He says it's becoming increasingly punitive and deterrent-based, and has lost much of the focus on reform and restoration. We might be wondering what Christians think of the way criminal justice is implemented today. Reform and restoration, well, that has a biblical ring to it, doesn't it? But does it work? Restorative justice is a Christian way of looking at criminal justice and, in particular, the issue of imprisonment. Well, our special guest today will be the Reverend Dr. Gordon Preece. He's Director of Ethos, the Evangelical Alliance's Centre for Christianity and Society. He's also Chair of the Melbourne Anglican Social Responsibilities Committee. Gordon Preece is Senior Minister at Yarraville Anglican Parish in Melbourne and is an award-winning author, editor of 13 books, as well as Zadok Perspectives, Equip, and the Engage Ethical Email. Gordon Preece, a special welcome back to 2020.
Thanks, Neil. And you're not a relative of Richard Johnson, are you, by any chance?
No, I'm not.
Not great grandfather or something.
We spell our name the same way, but no, there's no relational connection.
But no bias.
He is one of the heroes of faith here in Australia, though, and as the first chaplain, and of course the responsibility for setting up law and order, for introducing justice principles, and those were around biblical foundations. And so this is where we can say we certainly are a Christian nation, because a lot of the things that are implemented so far as criminal justice goes go right back to that first chaplain.
Absolutely. I think one of the things with Richard Johnson was he came from Wilberforce's group, the Clapham sect. He was certainly influenced by them, and they had interests in prison reform, and later on you had Elizabeth Fry, I think it was, who made a big difference in relationship to reform of prisons. And Richard Johnson, he is a bit of an unsung hero. The government basically wanted him to just kind of preach morality and keep the prisoners in line, whereas he was more interested in grace. Yes, there needed to be appropriate punishment, but he wanted to preach the gospel, and so to some extent got in trouble over that. He also had quite good relationships with at least some of the Aboriginal population, and had real concerns about that as well. So both of those factors, I think, are interesting, you know, for our discussion as we go on.
A wonderful reflection on Richard Johnson. And if you were contrasting him with the chaplain who followed him, talking about Samuel Marsden, who had the reputation of being the flogging parson, perhaps wrongly. But for our conversation today, there are different ways to approach criminal justice. And there was a very heavy-handedness that perhaps came in the second chaplain, in Samuel Marsden. But as you say, a certain grace that marked the first chaplain, Richard Johnson. And we might come
Yep. Oh, sorry, just with quickly, Marsden's a hero amongst some in New Zealand because as a missionary, and he was involved, I think, in the treaty that in the 1850s. We still don't have a treaty with our Indigenous people in Australia, but Marsden was involved in that. But in the Australian context, he was quite different, and so it's interesting that the system in England was you had gentry. You know, sort of upper class clergy who were often involved as magistrates. I don't think it's a good mix, frankly, but it's not a good look Christian-wise, I think.
It might not be a good mix, but it is an historic precedent.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
For our conversation today, to know that Christians might be interested in issues around criminal justice, we've got that precedent very well established here in Australia, and so no doubt listeners will be interested in your thoughts today, Gordon. And this goes not only with history and with theory, and, you know, people will know you're an academic as well, but you've got some personal connections here to the Russell Street bomber, Craig Minogue, and some of those sorts of reflections are a part of your thoughts around criminal justice.
Yes, well, I was reminded again, just is it the Newsreader or the News, that series that's just on Channel 2, ABC, mm-hmm. and we've been watching that, and the last episode on Sunday night was on the Russell Street bombing. That was a major part of that. And to watch that again was quite salutary. Like, it was an horrific event. It was a horrific crime. And it was orchestrated by a government-paid youth worker, in fact, who Craig and his brother had been both influenced by. Now, Craig was about 18 years old and semi-literate. And now Craig, it was a horrific crime. Craig admits it, and it was horrific. He wrote something for us called Inside My Skull. This is on Zadok Papers. And but Craig, he did actually kill someone in prison as well who had planned to kill him. I don't excuse him, but prison is a terrible and tough place. He has served his full sentence and came up for parole after about 30 years. And then the Victorian government, basically in a kind of election kind of move to show they were tough in terms of law and order, basically said he would be locked up for life and never let out again, etc., etc. And so virtually doubling his sentence in a way that the judge never envisaged. So it really took things out of the judge's hands in that sense.
So you have the court making an assessment and imposing a sentence, but at the end of that sentence, depending on the political climate, so you have this politicising of law and order, and no doubt for some people that's going to be an important element of who gets out of jail, but politicising law and order, that has its own consequence too.
Yes, absolutely, and I still have a kind of article pending called, it's a quote from Dante, "Abandon hope, all ye who enter here," which is actually talking about hell, but In the light of saying that the subtitle would be the end of reform in Australia's criminal justice system. And so I got to know Craig through a great friend of mine, Kevin Maddock, who worked for Prison Fellowship and then set up a Christian group for prisoners who came out from prison called Dorcas. And they have church meetings, they have support groups. The Church of Christ in Victoria supports them, and Kevin gave my book on Peter Singer to Craig Minogue and also Julian Knight, who was the Hoddle Street murderer, and the conversation with Julian Knight wasn't really, I don't think my letters were getting through to him, but with Craig it flourished. I visited him. And he was quite interested in Peter Singer as an ethicist, and I had written a book on Singer, critiquing Singer largely. And I visited him, and we continued to write. And Craig has been a real advocate for prisoner rights in jail, acknowledging, you know, the element of justice that has to be there in any kind of sentence. But he, for instance, has been strip searched 70 times. They have never found anything. This is in the name of sort of, you know, drugs or etc. And he was so he went to court over it, and it was found to be a violation of his human rights. And but the criminal justice system is apparently appealing against that. But so that's sort of one example of what I think is a grave injustice, frankly. Yes, it was a horrific crime, but which one of us would want to be judged for our whole lives of what we did at 18? Barely an adult.
No doubt. Listeners will be torn between the idea of being a little hard-nosed here when it comes to the idea of sentencing and for people who've committed horrendous crimes. And we might be even divided over the idea of allowing for a Christian compassion if there is some evidence that in fact works, because I wonder whether you've got any thoughts, Gordon, around the idea of inadequate sentencing here, because some people will say, well, if you get a life sentence, life means life, doesn't it? And that might be what leads to the politicising of the law and order issue here.
Yeah. Now, in Craig's case, it wasn't a life sentence. So it was, you know, the problem is that, you know, a life sentence was added on without another crime. But I think in terms of, yes, yeah, so a lot of people would take an eye for an eye view. And I think the problem with that is that while justice needs to be done and be seen to be done, and justice, the punishment fitting the crime, is an essential element of justice and criminal justice. C.S. Lewis is very big on that, and he wrote a critique of the humanitarian theory of punishment. And but in the biblical context, an eye for an eye is a limiting thing. It comes in response in Genesis 9 to Genesis 4, just after Cain and Abel, where violence kind of emerges in human society, and Lamech, who is one of their ancestors, he demands 70 times 7 vengeance against even a young man. 70 times unlimited vengeance is what he is wanting. So an eye for an eye is a limitation. And then you get, when we get to Jesus, what we get is Jesus talks about 70 times 7 forgiveness in Matthew 18. Unlimited forgiveness. Now, that doesn't deny a role for punishment and the role of the state in Romans 13. You know, the state has the sword, Paul says there. So it doesn't deny that, but certainly alongside it and flavouring it is a strong element of mercy as well, and openness to God's grace over time.
So many will be divided, and especially those who may have been victims of crime themselves, or families or friends of victims of crime, and no doubt there's going to be room for understanding the dreadful circumstance of the emotional impact of that. When you're talking about it objectively, and when people who are making laws and teaching about this, a really powerful impact on Jesus' words, 70 times 7, as you say, unlimited forgiveness.
Visions 2020 with Neil Johnson, a biblical perspective on life, culture, and current events.
Our talkback line open on 1-800-316-316 to join in our conversation today. And you might have your own thoughts on this balance or the differences between the punitive and deterrent-based ways of justice, or the other side of the coin, which might be around reform and restoration. Our special guest is the Reverend Dr. Gordon Preece. He's Director of Ethos, the Evangelical Alliance's Center for Christianity and Society. We're talking criminal justice. He's been writing about criminal justice of recent times. 1-800-316-316 to join in. Gordon, if we're talking about restorative justice, let's talk some context here, because three types of justice, the idea of preemptive justice, punitive justice, and restorative justice. I wonder if you've got any thoughts on those three different dimensions.
Yes, well, preemptive acts like, let's link that with, say, deterrence. So that is a kind of justice that was around the time when White Australia was founded. So you had children being locked up for enormous sentences. You had people being, fathers who had stolen a loaf of bread, being sentenced either in some cases to death, or the alternative then was transportation. They had massively overcrowded prisons, and people were stored in old ships on the Thames. And later, some were sent to Georgia in the US, and John Wesley tried to reform that, by the way, when he was over there, unsuccessfully. But and Australia was part of this process of sending people out and basically banished from family, everything that they knew to Australia. And so I think that was largely based on deterrence. It wasn't a case of the punishment fitting the crime when you had such enormous disproportionate punishments. Yes, punishment, the punishment fitting the crime is a basic tenet of justice. It is a foundational aspect of justice, and C.S. Lewis is right about that. But it doesn't end there. So that the idea of reform is based on the fact that over time people do change. So for instance, most people, or most crime, is committed between the ages of about 17 or 18 and mid-20s, overwhelmingly so, and there is basically worldwide, it's demonstrated, as a kind of natural kind of growing out of crime in the great majority of people. As I said, none of us would want to be judged too much for things that we did when we were 17 or 18. Like, I lost my driver's license when I was 18. It wasn't from a huge thing, but it was a number of things, a number of fines, and that. So I lost it for 3 months. And, you know, sort of
confession time youth, here, Gordon. That's good.
Yeah, you know, kind of youthful, yeah. Lack of responsibility or risk taking, in a sense, is something that particularly young males, and when we're talking about the overwhelming nature of crimes committed there by young males, that's a lot of what happens. People grow up. You know, there are literal biological things about this, the nature of people's brains actually being able to take into account longer-term consequences. And male brains actually take longer. Young men's brains actually take longer than young women's on that issue. So there's those sorts of aspects that if we were able to keep people out of jail during that period, now they need to have education, they need to be various things in relationship to them in order to try and bring about reform. But if I can move to the restorative thing, because I think there's a myth that this is regarded as being soft on crime, whereas a number of people I've been listening to in the Victorian inquiry into the criminal justice system, they are great pains to say, no, people need to face up to their crime, and they need to face up to their victims. And if they need to see them face to face, if possible, this has to be supervised. There's a whole sort of careful science around how to do this and mediated. But and it obviously needs to be voluntary, particularly from both sides, if it's going to work. But It's designed that you see from the inside, that you get a sense of what those people who have suffered in losing a loved one or whatever have experienced and the damage that you have actually done. And so it's designed to really bring people face to face with the enormity of the crime that they've actually committed,
and
then move on from there to enable the possibility of repentance and restoration.
I'm remembering a conversation that I think was either earlier this year or late last year with some representatives from the Sycamore Tree Project. And for listeners who are familiar with the biblical story of the sycamore tree that was climbed by
Zacchaeus.
And, of course, Zacchaeus then confronted by Jesus and has lunch with Jesus and understands that his taking more tax than is necessary actually reveals the crime, and, of course, then he changes direction. So this idea of grace and compassion and where Jesus might be in this, this is an important element for us thinking about these things as Christians, Gordon.
Absolutely. There is forgiveness. You know, I talked about 70 times seven forgiveness, but Jesus also talks about paying back, about reparation. Yeah. And in scripture, that's a large part of the nature of, if you like, criminal justice, that someone is to pay back in as far as possible. Because you want to say that you can't pay back when you've killed, you know, for someone dying. You can only show your remorse and determination not to do something like that in the future, but still that can mean something to people, and we do have plenty of examples of that and where it has worked and led to transformation. But in Zacchaeus's case, because given that the crime was about money, he paid it back, and he paid it back overwhelmingly. And there's great grace and forgiveness that comes to him in that context, and kind of reconciliation with those people who he had violated. But there is, you know, you do have to. It takes time to rebuild trust in that. You can forgive someone, but it will take time to rebuild trust for someone to earn, if you like, the community's trust again, or especially victims' trust. And that's certainly the case in, say, issues of abuse.
Only just a short while out from news, let's squeeze in a call here. Graham McLennan, who's well known to some listeners. Graham, welcome along.
Yes, Neil, thank you very much.
Graham, only a short time up to news. What are your thoughts for our conversation?
Well, a couple of things. There are several books written about a guy called Dr. Colin Browning, and he was in charge of some of the convict ships coming out, and in a sense of their spiritual and medical, I guess, health. And he taught them the Bible. He taught them to read first and taught them to about the scriptures, and many of them became Christians, and they were definitely reformed. But in Port Arthur, there are 280 boys, and one came under conviction of sin because the Butters, the Wesleyan minister, in 1835, talked to them about the Bible and the forgiveness for sins and needing repentance, and they came under conviction of sin, and over 40 boys became Christians and soundly converted, and they used to have prayer meetings together. And so there is that aspect where we try to be harsh to try and straighten the people out, but certainly that grace of knowing God's forgiveness, and even with people who are quite hardened criminals, even at part of Port Arthur, where similar things occurred to them, where they came under conviction of sin, repented, and led great lives afterwards, and were actually farmed out onto farms and so
Graham,
on.
Graham, a good boys. Contribution there, and I'm going to have to save any response from Reverend Dr. Gordon Priest till after news, because it's news time. Hey, Gordon, just coming back to the caller we had just before the news, Graham, who was talking about early restorative justice in Australia, and with some authority, given that Graham has been a receptacle for all sorts of wonderful historic content, our Christian history in Australia. But he included something very important I'll get your thoughts on. Richard Johnson and those early chaplains part of their restorative process was in teaching the Bible. I wonder if you've got any thoughts around that and the fact that that may not happen to the extent as it did in the early days.
Right. Yeah, it was a great comment we had from Graham. And when we look at Wilberforce and the Clapham sect and the early evangelicals in the early 19th century, partly stimulated by Wesley's challenge to get rid of slavery and that, they had people like Hannah Moore. Now, Hannah Moore was founder of the Sunday School movement. And the Sunday School movement was originally designed to basically teach people reading, but they used the Bible as the main source for teaching reading to people. So you were helping people educationally, spiritually, in every way, preparing them for possibly being able to get a job, educating them for that, in that sense. So you had the whole package in the way they actually did that, and that particularly affected the poor who didn't have that kind of opportunity before. I think that when we look at Port Arthur, what we find there is a stark contrast between, say, the Christian influence, which was more restorative and more open to grace, than a utilitarian view. Now, utilitarianism basically was founded at the end of the 18th century, and the idea was they believed it was sort of you could have scientific measurements of punishment and pleasure, and you would use those to try and change people. And so what they you would have very, very strict punishment, and that's what you had in Port Arthur in particular. And even in the chapel, they had built it so that people stood up with it. They were confined within a little cubicle, so even kind of imprisoned within the church, the chapel of Port Arthur. And it was meant to just apply rewards and punishments within that. So there was there wasn't a sense of community and relationship, but the chaplains tried to introduce that as much as possible, and the possibility of restoration, and through teaching, reading, and the Bible, to give people that second chance, and were often very successful in terms of that.
And wonderful to reflect on Port Arthur, because so many of our listeners will have visited Port Arthur in Tasmania, and I'm pretty sure you're talking about the big church building that you walk into, and I think it was burnt down by convicts there. But as you say, they were separated at the time. But just reflecting on that, the very fact that there is a large church remnant there illustrates the place of the Bible in the punitive nature of what Port Arthur was, a dreadful place to be, but there was a church, and that the convicts did go along to a church. And let me reflect here for a moment, because some people say, was Australia ever really a Christian nation? Well, there's an illustration there in itself. But over the next 120 years, almost every Australian was led to attend church and to identify as Christian and grow into a very morally upright Australia. And perhaps we're losing some of that now, but certainly those Christian foundations are very powerfully there. Coming back to this restorative justice idea, Gordon, the Raise the Age campaign, talking about young people here, under 14s in particular, and especially Indigenous children. You've had some thoughts around young people and how they're affected by these criminal justice processes.
Yes, I think it's astonishing that I think in Australia we have about 600 children, I think, in that age group who were imprisoned in various ways. So have various forms of youth detention, but also sometimes mixed in with adults. And in practice, and it's, I think, two-thirds of those are Indigenous. And they're usually for very, very petty kinds of crimes, and sometimes based on mandatory sentencing. It could be, you know, three very petty kinds of crimes that could have been committed, you know, taking some lollies from a shop or something like that. And we're part of the World Evangelical Alliance, and they reviewed Australia's human rights record just recently in the last year, and I was working with them on that. And one of the main things that Australia scored very badly for in a world where it's overwhelmingly 14 or more is the age limit below which you should not imprison children. We got very strong sort of reactions about Australia's record in relationship to that. And the fact is, we also have many, many Aboriginal deaths in custody. That's been over 500, I think, since the Royal Commission into that, led by a Christian judge at the time. And it's averages about 15 per annum. I actually took a funeral for David Gundry, who was an Aboriginal man. This is in 1989 in Sydney, in Redfern or Newtown, and he was shot, and he was a victim of mistaken identity by a police SWAT squad, and they haven't actually changed their practices. And it was pretty much sort of swept under the carpet. And I had a prison in my parish, Long Bay Jail, in Malabar. And they have had, there was a David Dungay, episode where he died in custody relatively recently. And he has been the key, person in relationship to a kind of Black Lives Matter, process. So, particularly with younger children, what tends to happen is you basically end up training them in crime. There are some good alternatives. So just around the corner from where I live is a place called Parkville Detention, Youth Detention Centre. And they used to have Parkville College there, which was led by a great educationalist. And it did very well. But when that was disbanded or not promoted as much, afterwards they ended up with riots from some of the detainees there. I remember my wife going in there representing Asthma Victoria, and she said she just felt so sorry for them. They looked like they'd never seen the sun, and just kind of brought out her motherly heart and compassion, and very sort of pimply, and it's not a good environment. And Parkville College, though, did make a difference in that context. So I think that's something important. Some of the other things are that, you know, homelessness, for instance, masses of people go from being homeless into prison, and through petty crime or being caught for it. When I ran a homeless ministry called Urban Seed behind Collins Street Baptist in Melbourne, in the early 2000s, when there was massive heroin overdosing going on, particularly in the lane just behind Collins Street Baptist. And a lot of people were homeless, and there was crime in relationship to heroin, the explosion in heroin in the early 2000s. And there were a lot of people who are picked up for things like not paying their fare on trams. And we would have the lawyers, the sort of free public lawyers, come in after lunch. Well, they would have lunch with us, and they would talk to people about their situations. And that kept a lot of people out of jail. At the moment, a lot of people are going in, and a lot of young people and a lot of women in Victoria, because of toughening up of bail conditions. Now, that was because of some very sort of famous examples where people got out and on bail and committed bad crimes. Now, they were terrible cases, but they were very much the exception. What's happened now is remand, which is where people are waiting until their court case comes up. People are basically locked up, and they can actually serve longer there. With a massive backlog in Victoria and extended by because of COVID. And a lot of young people are in that situation, a lot of women, including victims of domestic violence, but who somehow get caught up and are locked up as well, and their children are in there. And it's a disaster for the prison system and for their rehabilitation prospects.
Gordon, I wonder if you've got a thought or two here, because it seems to me, as you're reflecting on those things, that media coverage of children who do commit horrendous crimes, that colours the treatment of all children, even those ones who are guilty of committing some petty crimes. And so you've got petty criminals who are coloured with the same brush as those who are committing some horrendous crimes. That's the real challenge here, by the sound of it.
Absolutely. And I think one of the reasons why the attorneys general, the state attorneys general, haven't really acted on this yet is, well, I've heard Amanda Stoker, who was shadow attorney general, in speaking in Parliament. I actually asked her a question one time, and she said she was concerned about the issue, but she said part of the reason was because of young people, radicalised people on the way to terrorism. Now, I think what you should do in that case is have some distinction between the more extreme cases and the other more petty cases, which is the overwhelming number of cases. Because, in fact, you know, there are people who get radicalised in prison as well. So you can, you're actually making for a worse problem in terms of doing that.
Is there
in Queensland?
Is there a sense here, Gordon, somehow or other, you have to say we need to trust the judges and the magistrates who are making the decisions because they are well informed, rather than allow this idea that all young people are going to be evil if there are some who could be radicalised or some who've committed terrible crimes? Somehow or other, you've got to put your trust in the way that the justice system works. Otherwise, you've got this sort of trial by mob that comes via media, and then that affecting the political ways that people are politicising criminal justice. Is that a fair enough description of how things get out of control?
Yes, I think so. And often what you find is there are young people who basically have no one kind of representing them. Or there's a case of legal aid, but a lot of cases, legal aid reductions have meant that people meet you for only 10, 15 minutes, if you're lucky, in terms of meet with the person who's charged just beforehand. And I was in one case where I was with a young person, and they made a mistake. Now, I appreciated the help of this legal aid person, but they actually said that the young person wasn't conforming in terms of taking the medication. They had a mental health issue. And I put my hand up, and there's hardly anyone in the court, and the judge is a female judge, and I asked, excuse me, judge, but could I correct something? And I said, they've been very conforming to their medication. And this was in New South Wales, and was able to correct that. And at the end, the judge said, "I can see to the young man concerned, you know, that you have very loving, caring support, and they basically enabled them to be they have no record and not be charged, etc. And they have absolutely remarkably reformed." I've had the same situation with someone once in one of my churches, and I went with them in the court case. I'd written them a reference, and at the end of the judge summing up, he mentioned my reference, and that person has gone on. They're a mother. They had a child. And they have reformed remarkably as well.
Gordon, is there room here for honouring those prison ministries? And we'll talk about prison chaplains, and you know, we've mentioned ones like Prison Fellowship or Kairos, wonderful prison ministries. And in the absence of the idea that there might be mandatory Bible study and reform that's coming from the government, we have to rely on those prison chaplains, those pastors, prison ministries who are interacting with prisoners here for the ways that reform might happen, and to overcome the recidivism, the committing new crimes on being let out of jail. What are your thoughts for those prison ministries?
Oh, look, I think they're absolutely fundamental. And the other thing I do these days, I'm no longer in parish, but I work with Catholic Social Services Victoria as a senior policy officer half-time. And we spoke with our chaplains recently, and the stories that they could tell, and of their work with people, and cases where there had been real reform, and also that the need for making links when people come out from prison, because otherwise what happens is a lot of people go in homeless and they come out homeless. They might have two nights in a motel that's paid for, and then they've actually got to find somewhere. And basically, hardly anyone, you don't have Centrelink set up beforehand, for instance. So they've got no money at all. They've got to somehow work out how do they get some money to be able to get a roof over their head. So you're almost setting someone up for failure in those situations. So the links between chaplaincy within the prison and, say, groups that work with people immediately outside prison, and the systems of social welfare and other things that are set up before they go out, are absolutely critical. 50% of people end up going back into prison, largely for petty sorts of crimes, but that's within 2 years. Gordon, and that is just a jailing is failing.
I wish we had more time to explore a whole lot of dimensions here, but let me bring you to a role that church might have. As you talk about peer and mentor supports, mm-hmm. and it's not everybody's cup of tea, but there are going to be people listening to our conversation today, part of churches, and churches who are thinking, how can we help those who are coming out of prison in our community? What are your thoughts here for churches and a response here to these ways that criminal justice perhaps is failing?
Well, I think one possibility is housing, but I think that would be more likely, let's say people had a granny flat or something, that would be more likely in the context where someone had built a relationship through visiting someone in prison or whatever. Churches sometimes have accommodation that may be available, and I think that could be worked out with proper support systems and accountability systems. And so I think you need both. And I think churches as a whole could be investing more in prison ministries, in chaplaincy, and because it is shown to be very effective. And so I think that's something that we need to invest in and look at supporting those ministries. And like Dorcas that I mentioned, prison fellowship and chaplaincy ministries. We need a range of those things. And being really, really welcoming to people. I've been in congregations where there have been people who have served time, and where people have befriended them and tried to give them opportunities. My father, in his business, he knew someone who was a bricklayer who taught people bricklaying skills in prisons. And he would make the link to my father, who is a Christian man, and his concrete products business. He would have some people just out of prison who would work for him.
Well, I know listeners will be able to hear a pastoral heart in all of those involvements that you've had over these past years, Gordon Preece, and people will appreciate that you've thought very deeply through these issues. And I wonder whether, is there an article, is there something that we can point listeners to today? Those who are interested in taking this another step deeper, I'll give the website, the ethos.org.au website, but is there a particular article that people could look to?
In some ways, it's coming. So I've got to get something together by the 17th to a submission to the this Criminal Justice Review, and would be glad to be contacted about that. Probably best at gordon@ethos.org.au, and so I could send something up with that. And the material that I sent through to you, Neil, that I'm happy for that to go out to other people, including there's something from a friend of mine, a colleague of mine, there, which is quite a good outline about some of the issues. Lindsay Wilson, who's a lawyer and Old Testament scholar.
Okay. Well, you've given your personal email there, gordon@ethos.org.au. And Gordon Preece is Director of Ethos, the Evangelical Alliance's Centre for Christianity and Society. So you can have a direct contact if this is something that's right up your alley. You want to know some more. You want to take things a little deeper here. You want to be on the receiving end of that article when it comes out later this month. gordon@ethos.org.au. And, of course, there are many articles on the Ethos website, ethos.org.au. Also, those number of publications that worth a mention here, those publications that you're a part of, Zadok Perspectives, Equip, and the Engage Ethical Email, you can access those all from the Ethos website, Gordon?
Yes, you can get most of them. Zadok Perspectives is subscription-based. We just won the Gutenberg Award last Saturday for, a long-term contribution in relationship to religious publishing, and it is a great publication and deals with a lot of these kinds of issues. So if I can get that plug in, thanks.
Yeah, look, a plug for it, Zadok, the Gutenberg Award, and you'll be able to access how you can link to that and subscribe to Zadok at ethos.org.au. The Reverend Dr. Gordon Preece. Gordon, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts and your heart with us today on 2020.
Thanks very much, Neil.
Thanks for taking time to listen to this audio on demand from Vision Christian Media. To find out more about us, go to vision.org.au.